Welcome, everybody, to Tokens of Wisdom. I'm your host, Dave Rothschild, a partner at Cole Freeman & Mallon, a boutique law firm based in San Francisco with one of the leading private fund practices on the West Coast. Before we dive into the episode, like always, please listen to the disclaimer at the end of the show. Nothing I say here is legal, investment, or tax advice. Okay, fine. Maybe it wasn't who shot JR, but the end of my last episode is the lawyer talking to himself about law stuff podcast version of a compelling cliffhanger. Hey, I got you to come back. For a quick refresh, last episode we talked about the SEC's venture capital fund definition and discussed how if an advisor manages only venture capital funds, there is no AUM ceiling on its ability to remain exempt from registration. If that same advisor manages money for any non-venture capital fund, it has to register as an investment advisor once AUM hits $150 million, if not before. Occasionally, a large VC fund advisor might have a compelling hedge fund idea. If they're already over $150 million in AUM, they can't launch that hedge fund before registering as an investment advisor. In my experience, I tend to find the VC fund advisor community quite averse to this kind of regulation, and they gag all over the idea of becoming an RIA. Why don't we just form a new advisor entity, they say? We'll keep all the VC funds under the existing advisor and form a new entity to advise the hedge fund. As long as the hedge fund is below $150 million, the hedge fund advisor can be an exempt reporting advisor too. That way, I won't jeopardize my VC fund advisor exemption. Of course, venture fund advisors aren't the only ones with genius ideas to avoid regulation. Non-venture fund managers sometimes have the same idea. Their first fund is successful and growing, and they're approaching that $150 million AUM ceiling. But they have an idea for another fund. Fund 2 would bump them way over $150 million in AUM, so they think, I'll just start a new entity to advise Fund 2. Each of them will manage less than $150 million, so each can be exempt. Ha ha ha! Stupid government! I can just keep forming new advisor entities nonstop and circumvent their oppressive regulation. Well, not so fast. If the wool could be pulled over Uncle Sam's eyes that easily, FTX would still be throwing ragers in the Bahamas, Theranos would still be pricking our fingers for no reason, and the seventh inning stretch would feature rousing renditions of God Save the Queen. Actually, is it God Save the King now? I don't really know how the lyrics work after the monarch changes. In all seriousness, though, as I alluded to last time, the SEC is not that stupid, much to all of our chagrin. They have a doctrine of advisor integration, where under certain circumstances, two ostensibly separate investment advisor entities are treated as one business for Advisors Act compliance purposes. In our couple examples above, one, the large VC fund advisor and its separate affiliated hedge fund manager, they probably have to register because their combined AUM is over $150 million, and they have at least one fund that's not a VC fund. The two separate hedge fund managers, their combined AUM would be well over $150 million, and they would have to register. In each case, unless they gave thoughtful consideration to structuring their separate advisor entities to make them operationally independent of each other, which we're going to talk about in a second. So this naturally begs the question, under what circumstances are two ostensibly separate investment advisor entities treated as one business? And here comes the classic lawyer answer you all love and admire. It depends. In this case, it really does depend. Advisor integration is one of those thorny circumstances where no two situations are exactly alike, and all the facts and all the circumstances surrounding the two businesses matter a lot. The overarching question the SEC asks is this, which I alluded to earlier. Are the two entities operationally independent of each other? And to answer that question, you have to analyze all the facts and circumstances surrounding the two businesses. Sometimes the analysis is super easy. In my fake examples above, the duplicitous managers are just seeking to avoid regulation, but their two ostensibly separate advisors would have the same owners, the same employees, the same offices, etc. Easy peasy. Those two advisors are not operationally independent of each other and would be integrated. Going the other way, some investors like to seed investment managers and buy minority stakes in various management companies. Just because two advisors share a minority passive investor would not, by itself, result in those two advisors being integrated. Of course, in most cases, the facts and circumstances fall somewhere in the middle, and the analysis is a lot less clear. How do you even go about analyzing two businesses like this? What kinds of factors do you look at? More importantly, what kinds of factors does the SEC look at when it's bringing an enforcement action against someone for violating its rules? Well, I think there are four distinct factors that the SEC typically focuses on. And this is all kind of cobbled together from no action letters and less formal guidance the SEC has issued over the years. There is not a section of the Advisors Act that talks through advisor integration, the definition of operational independence, etc. Those four distinct factors are capital structure, control, personnel, and investment decision-making. Now, these all kind of blend together a little bit in some areas, but they're all kind of distinct in other areas. So in my typical fashion, I'm going to run through them one by one. Number one, capital structure. So this looks at whether the two entities are each adequately capitalized, such that they can operate independently of each other. We're looking for operational independence, after all. If one advisor depends on the other for working capital, that would be a factor in favor of integration. If they commingle assets or fail to respect the corporate formalities of each business, that's a major red flag and would augur toward integration. Note, of course, that this applies to businesses generally. Always respect the corporate formalities of your various entities and don't commingle funds or other assets. Yes, you need a separate bank account for each entity. Annoying though it is to set up bank accounts sometimes. So that's capital structure. Number two is control. Are the two entities under common control? While not totally dispositive to the analysis, it's a factor that trends toward integration if the two entities are under common control. Same thing if they share ownership stakes in one another. So if one's a subsidiary of the other, it's more likely that they're going to be integrated. Number three, personnel. Do the two entities share employees, managers, directors, or other personnel? If yes, what functions do the shared employees perform? If you're sharing a secretary or a back office person, that's less likely to result in integration than if you're sharing the same portfolio manager and it's the same people making investment decisions for both advisor entities. Which brings us to point number four, investment decision-making functions and operations. Do the advisors independently make investment decisions for their clients? If it's the same people making those decisions for both entities, it's harder to make that claim. Do the different entities each use their own resources and research, or do they pool resources and research in making investment decisions? Do the advisors solicit clients for each other or share client confidential information between them? That would certainly augur toward integration. Or do they claim any linkage in client communications? Do the marketing materials for advisor B talk about their affiliation with advisor A and how that makes them better? If so, they're more likely to be integrated. Now, like I mentioned before, I call these four distinct areas, but they're all interconnected. Personnel and investment decision-making are connected. Linkage and commingling are interconnected, etc. And as I'm sure you can appreciate, there are millions of different possible arrangements, millions of ways to structure two businesses, and there are no bright line rules about advisor integration. Like I said, there's not some definition in the Advisors Act of operational independence that you can just meet. It's all sort of a gray area and requires a lot of bespoke, specific analysis. Depending on the relevant facts at play with two separate advisors, there may be ways to structure the entities to achieve sufficient separation and avoid integration. Depending on all the facts at play, maybe you could insert a board of directors at one advisor entity that's totally independent of the other advisor entity, invest in them investment decision-making authority, and make an argument that that extra layer of independent control moves you further away from integration. Now, of course, you're going to hear this again in my disclaimer at the end of the show. If this kind of analysis is relevant to you and your business, make sure you hire competent counsel to help you analyze your business and figure out the facts that apply to you. And be aware, you still might get it wrong. Turns out the SEC has a pretty long track record of looking at facts and circumstances and reaching different conclusions than were reached by the lawyers and investment professionals who looked at them originally. Well, now that all that boring regulatory analysis is out of the way, it's time for the part you've all been waiting for. The legal disclaimer. In this show, I describe laws and regulations from a 10,000-foot view, and while this should be obvious to most, I need to say it nonetheless. This show is for informational purposes only, and nothing said here constitutes legal, investment, or tax advice. If you're thinking about starting a fund or you're curious about what's involved, this show is a good resource as you explore your options. But if you're going to pull the trigger and launch a fund, please engage an attorney to assist you. Thanks for listening to Tokens of Wisdom with Dave Rothschild. I hope you enjoyed this episode. Please like, follow, and subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts, and tell your friends about us. Last but not least, if you have any questions about what we discussed today, feel free to send us an email at tow@colefreeman.com, spelled out in the show notes.